We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
No Maria again today. She's on her last, she's using up her last chit to to be able to take a break for the year.
Yeah, we're gonna dock her pay if she.
That's right.
If she does this again.
That's right. All right. Starting out with local, and one of the hopefuls in the mayor's race appears to officially not be throwing his hat in the ring.
Well, Peter Steinbrück was never actually a hopeful. What he was a lot of other people's hopeful. Very similar to Nick Licata, where they personally didn't particularly want to run for mayor in each case because it didn't really suit them. Licata is much more of a legislator, and I think was also at this point debating about whether to retire or not. He's again running for city council after his long torturous decision. Steinbrück is a big picture kind of guy. He really is not that enthusiastic, I think, for the sort of nitty gritty of day to day governance that comes with the executive branch position that is the mayor's office. So he announced this week that he's taking a fellowship at Harvard instead for the next year. The maddening part about this is that Steinbrück found out that he was doing this about a week before he announced it publicly. So for all this time, you had the Facebook groups and all the various people urging Peter to run when he knew perfectly well he was not going to run, and that prevented by a week, which, you know, doesn't sound like much, but it actually, in terms of the amount of time that's still available for people to get behind some kind of a progressive alternative to the three current candidates, it's an eternity. You know, they were, a lot of people are putting their eggs in his particular basket when he knew he wasn't going to run. So that, I think, was a problem. We are left now with three candidates. Mike McGinn, the former Sierra Club head, who is, as one social justice advocate described to me, a limousine environmentalist who is very good on environmental issues, although policy-wise is somewhat indistinguishable from how Greg Nichols has handled density issues and neighborhood development and so forth, and who was also rather disturbing in his opening mayoral run with things like calls for the city to take over the school district, a measure which has failed spectacularly in every major urban district in which it's been tried. He spent some time, you know, demagoguing on some other issues that weren't really particularly encouraging in terms of both his grasp on city politics and how progressive he is. And then there's James Donaldson, who's running on the small business ticket and doing so from what at least initially seems like a right wing standpoint. So there really isn't a progressive voice in the mayoral's run this year from any kind of a large credible candidate, even though a lot of people have been trying to recruit one for really a year now, and time is getting very, very late.
Yeah, what they have till June or July?
Well, they have until July.
Although traditionally you'd want to start ahead.
Yeah, they have until, I believe it's the end of June now with the earlier primary for people to file. The problem is that, you know, with the amount of money that needs to be raised to run a credible campaign, Greg Nichols already has $300,000 in the bank. He raised well over $500,000 last time, even though he didn't have a credible candidate and opponent in 2005. To raise that kind of a money requires a good deal of lead time. Ideally, a campaign should have started in January. And, you know, that may or may not be fair, but, you know, in terms of media coverage, a lot of journalists look at how much money a candidate has raised as a measure of how serious they are and whether to give them airtime or not. So somebody who just decides one day, oh, hey, I have no electoral experience and nobody knows who I am, but I'll file for mayor. You know, there are always a number of people like that on the ballot, and whether they get treated seriously in terms of news coverage and being allowed to participate in endorsement interviews and debates and forums and so forth, all those decisions come down in many cases to name familiarity and money, and we really don't have any candidates right now who have those from the progressive end.
And never ceases to amaze me with how many years we've been doing like this show that and the criticisms of the people in office that there just doesn't really ever appear to be solid candidates, or they seem very rare and far between.
They're very rare and far between. I mean, the last time we had we've got one really pretty a pretty solid progressive running for city council this year in David Bloom. We had another one last time in Joe Swaya, but he got into the race very late and ran a very ineffective campaign against Gene Godden. The last winning candidate of that type, you know, arguably you could say Judy Nicastro, but I think really you'd have to go back to Nick Licata's original race 12 years ago, and that's a long, long time in city politics.
All right.
And Peter Steinbrück, I think, came in about the same time.
Moving on to the state level, and Olympia, the legislature still has like another week to go, is that right?
That is correct, but bills are already moving through the pipeline, as is rarely communicated by the media. The state legislators have an enormous amount of number of bills to consider in any given legislative session, and that task is complicated this week quite a bit by the fact that there's this yawning, gaping, you know, sucking wound in the middle of the state budget. But there were several notable bills that did pass this week or passed one of the houses. Both houses of the state legislature passed a bill this week that would fund a UW Human Rights Center. That's good news for the folks who backed that. The House has, the state legislature also passed full rights to domestic partners. And this is a bill that Christine Gregoire again has said that she would sign. This, basically went through the entire state legal code and wherever it says marriage, made it to say domestic partners, so that would include same-sex partnership, which again is very good news. And the House passed a bill that now goes on to the Senate to tell toll 520 as a predecessor to raising the money that will be necessary to build a new bridge. Now this is kind of a mixed bag. The revenue certainly is needed, particularly this year. But if you put a toll booth on 520 without doing something about I-90, an enormous number of people are just going to take I-90. That's already happening during rush hours when 520 is basically in gridlock for about 3 or 4 hours each day, where it's much, much faster to, you know, drive the extra 8 miles and go around, you know, go through downtown or go down through Bellevue and go across the bridge and go back up the other side. And that happens a lot because I-90 usually is not as congested. This is going to add to that, and it's going to make the traffic problems on I-90 worse. And of course, it also contributes to additional miles driven and is environmentally suspect. So, you know, I don't know what you do about that. Probably the logical solution would be to toll I-90 as well, but that might alienate people on Mercer Island. But no.
Well, they got, geez, half of it's under a friggin' tunnel over there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's true. So.
I'm sure they can see it from their boats. As well as there was some legislation this week passed regarding MRSA. I know that because that was an issue we covered on the show, not necessarily on this half hour, but previously on an interview with requiring hospitals to actually test whether their patients have MRSA or not. So, All right. Moving on, sticking with the state, and normally numbers being up would be a good thing on the corporate media, but in this case, we're talking about unemployment numbers.
Yeah, the state unemployment rate now has gone up significantly. It's now 9.2% as of the end of March for the state, 8.1% in the Seattle area. For many, many months, the state and local unemployment rates had been doing significantly better than the national average. That is starting to change. We're starting to catch up with the rest of the country as the economy hits home. And, you know, just anecdotally, you're seeing a lot of those results in people who've been laid off, people who are struggling to make ends meet. You know, if you look for any particular job opening on a place like Craigslist, and there's you know, just an enormous number of job seekers that are out there right now. So tough economic times all the way around.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the while you're saying that, the headlines out of this week that specific employers. I know Boeing did further layoffs. City of Seattle. They're talking about Greg Nichols laying a bunch of people off.
Yeah, they're going to close the library for a week in August.
University of Washington, 1,000 people there. So, all right. So that then takes us on to national news.
Did we want to mention the Post Globe?
Oh yeah. Just started this week. Another offshoot of the Seattle PI.
Yes, this done by some former PI columnists and reporters, Art Thiel and Kerry Murakami being two of the more recognizable names. This SeattlePostGlobe.org, and unlike the SeattlePI.com, which is it's been a huge disappointment so far anyway, the Post Globe is kind of a disappointment too. I mean, you look at them right now, and half of their stories are about sports, a couple of them are, heartwarming human interest stories, which, is what sells in a daily newspaper, but doesn't really translate as much onto the online world. Well, maybe the sports does, but it's not like that's where there's a gaping hole in the local media landscape. There's plenty of, in addition to the Seattle Times and all the local TV stations, there's an enormous number of blogs that are devoted to the local sports scene. That's not where the need is right now. The need is for somebody to go out and provide comprehensive local political and cultural journalism, and that's just not happening yet. Even with the two offshoots of the old PI now competing against each other and against the Seattle Times and trying to vie for readers and trying to figure out a way to monetize the web, which has always been the huge problem.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, they are just getting started.
Yeah. It's very early days.
Half a dozen writers with no financial backing. It's
very early days, obviously.
Yeah. So, but one to keep an eye on and perhaps support. Okay, moving on to national and pretty critical memos coming out this week. That was a long time in the making.
Yeah, and critical in the sense of being important, not necessarily in the sense of being, criticizing. But the torture memos that were released written under the Bush administration, finally being released this week by the Obama administration. And for anybody who has not had the time to read through them, you really should. I mean, but don't do it right after a meal, because it's really kind of sickening stuff. Page after page after page of the Bush administration lawyers and officials, Jay Bybee, John Yoo, etc., making these detailed arguments about why particular tortures were okay and legal up to a certain point, trying to calculate the amount of human suffering that was permissible to under the law to inflict before it actually became difficult, and not recognizing any of the opposing arguments, really just from a legal standpoint, extremely flawed documents. But trying to decide, for instance, how many days somebody can be suspended from the ceiling and held without food or water before it actually becomes torture. It's just insane kind of stuff. These are crimes, and they should be prosecuted. And that was the other half of what happened this week, is the Obama administration saying that CIA officers and other people who actually carried out interrogations based upon these legal justifications from the Department of Justice under the Bush administration, that they should not be prosecuted because they thought what they were doing was legal. Well, anybody with an ounce of common sense knew that this was torture, knew that this was illegal, and the defense that I was just following orders, this goes back to the taunt from the first grade playground. If somebody told you to jump off a cliff, would you go do it? It also goes back to the Nuremberg trials and specific to war crimes, of which torture is one. The United States is a signatory to treaties that says that following orders is not a defense. And international law also says that just because a country's legal system declares that something is legal does not necessarily make it so, that there are absolute things which are illegal, which are crimes against humanity. Torture is one of those, as are things like, use of chemical weapons and, mass murder and, things like that. you know, this is one of the great crimes that can be committed, and yet we're going to allow people like, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney to live their lives in comfort as long as they don't travel abroad, and rake in, you know, thousands of dollars of speaking fees and have libraries named after them. It really is kind of sickening. You know, the whole defense also, well, we need to let the past be the past. That's a defense that can be used in any crime. You know, I just went out and you know, robbed and raped and murdered, and the police, you know, bring me in for questioning about it. And so, I murdered those six women in the hotel room, but let's not dwell on the past. Let's just move forward. You know, it's, and these are crimes which are far worse than that. They're crimes which led directly to the deaths of a number of people that we already know about, which certainly led to experiences which will scar many, many untold number of other people for life. There are crimes which, you know, tainted the moral standing such it is in the United States around the world. That being said, we also had a decision this week by the Spanish Attorney General not to prosecute Bush administration officials for war crimes, for torture at Guantanamo, specifically against several different Spanish citizens. And that was a decision which, according to, you know, all the back channel information that is out there, was the result of intense and heavy lobbying by the United States to government and by the Obama administration to not proceed with that. So, you know, I understand the need to unify the country, and, you know, this is based to some degree on the whole truth and reconciliation model of, well, let's let there be disclosure of what happened and then let's move on. But this is not a question of something that was done because the United States was under a dire external threat. This was a crime that was, that is to say, the bombing of the World Trade Center, that was called a war and then responded to with another crime that was, in many ways just as grave.
But in the case of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that they had in South Africa, at least there they had to come forward and admit what they did. And
yes.
There's none of that here.
There's none of that there. In fact,
I mean, we're not even getting names of who was involved.
In fact, you've got people like Douglas Feith going around and saying that this, you know, this is all abhorrent because all of those crimes were in fact not crimes, but were essential to national security. I mean, Dick Cheney was making that case just last week, which is, you know, that's why he needs to be in jail, quite frankly.
Moving on, we have the EPA has apparently discovered greenhouse gases finally.
Yes, this is something that should have happened in, let's not just go blame the Bush administration. It really should have happened in the mid-90s. But the EPA, knowing that the atmosphere and the process of nature can wait for political and economic and realities, has finally decided that, yes, greenhouse gas emissions are in fact a pollutant. Yes, they can actually harm the health of the public. And therefore, yes, the Environmental Protection Agency, has the authority to actually, protect people from, hazards to the environment. So the next step in this house, and that's a formal ruling that has been made that now allows the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases. Now, the next question is whether the EPA will actually do that, will actually put forward regulations for greenhouse gases. The bet is that it will not, that it will wait for Congress to do something. The political reality of this is that there are a number of senators and representatives, both Republican and Democratic, from big, you know, coal-fire generating plants, particularly in the Midwest, who really object to the whole idea of regulating greenhouse gases because it might, God forbid, hurt the economy, as if putting half of Florida underwater wouldn't hurt the economy. So there, the goal once again is to try to regulate these gases. What will probably happen in Congress is some sort of very watered down legislation that really doesn't do an adequate job of making an impact in the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, which are still among the highest in the world and still desperately need to be curtailed. So now would be a good time to start urging our elected representatives, and that includes both Republicans and Democrats, because there's no guarantee that the Democrats will come down on the right side on this issue, to demand full and meaningful regulation of greenhouse gas emissions, and also legislative support and money for public transportations and alternatives to private automobile travel, and also money for R&D for developing automobiles which have less of an impact on the environment.
Tell you, watered down is going to have a whole new meaning when you're one of the people who live in those coastal areas.
That's very true.
All right, moving on to international, and something I didn't expect to see in my lifetime, a change on U.S. policy with Cuba.
Well, and yes, it's
changed. I mean, not dramatic, but
it's change you can measure in ounces. yeah, the Obama administration announcing this week that it will allow Cuban Americans, and by that, it's anybody who has even a second cousin in Cuba. I mean, it actually goes back, I think, three times removed in terms of how close or distant a relative you need to be in order to travel there. But they will, in fact, be allowed to travel to Cuba. And that's good, and that's certainly what the media coverage was focused on. What the media coverage did not focus on was all of the other pieces of the puzzle that were left in place. So the United States still has a trade embargo with Cuba. It still does not legally allow most all Americans, and that is to say everybody who's not of Cuban American descent, to travel to Cuba. You know, practically speaking, you can still do it. You just have to go through Canada or Mexico, and then you have to make sure, which the Cuban government, like the old Soviet Union, will certainly cooperate in this. They won't stamp your passport, so that, you know, there's no evidence that you've actually been to the country in terms of official documentation that you can be prosecuted for. But legally speaking, there's no right for most Americans to travel to Cuba. Even for Cuban Americans, they still have to go through third countries at this point, because there's no airlines that connect the United States with Cuba, obviously. And, you know, that may be popping up where they have, you know, one or two flights a week from Miami or something like that. But, you know, practically speaking, there's still a difficult time getting to Cuba without going through other countries. Now, bear in mind that the United States is doing all of this because Cuba has a communist government with a bad human rights record. That's very well and very true. However, the communist government with an atrocious human rights record, far worse than is the case in Cuba, happens to be our largest trading partner, that is to say China, and they happen to be the country that we owe most of our money to, that we have allowed to own our government lock, stock, and barrel. The normalization of a country that we went to war with for several years in Vietnam, that is still a communist government that we don't have any of these kind of restrictions with. The entire policy is basically the political impact of a very noisy small minority of elderly Cuban Americans and their descendants who are members of the Batista regime in Cuba, and it's outdated. And it needs to be repealed now.
The thing I actually thought was significant that was briefly mentioned in that policy change was that the other thing they were doing was opening up Cuba to U.S. corporations selling phones, computers, and the related services, which is major for those companies. I mean, you know, that's a very ripe market.
Yes, it is. And, of course, that does not necessarily mean that the Cuban government will allow them to come in.
No, but they will be able to. They've already tested their surveillance stuff on U.S. citizens, so they will actually already have that in place when they do sell those. All right, finally, on international, a U.N. conference coming up.
Yeah, the U.N. conference on racism is happening in Geneva next week. Now, for people with long memories, you may remember that 8 years ago, for the last U.N. conference on racism that was held in Durban, South Africa, the United States and Israel, under the Bush administration, walked out on the conference over specific criticisms of Israel for racism in its policies of essentially apartheid against Palestinians and Arabs in its occupation of Palestinian land. Now the United States, ironically, is threatening that it may or may not attend the entire conference at all to begin with in Geneva next week, saying, you know, agree to our demands or we won't come to the conference and negotiate, which sounds, you know, vaguely like the Bush administration. More change you can measure in ounces. The irony here, of course, is that the United States became really an international symbol for combating racism with the election of Barack Obama to the presidency, and now the Obama administration is talking about not attending a conference on racism. It's a very, very discouraging reminder that the United States is still light years behind most of the rest of the world when it comes to issues of social justice.
What is that saying you used to use all the time? It boggles the mind?
It boggles the mind, yes.
Okay, events coming up this week?
Several events this week. Wednesday night, Finney Neighbors for Peace and Justice is hosting a very distinguished speaker on the Afghan war and what's happening in Afghanistan right now. That'll be at Woodland Park Presbyterian Church, 70th and Greenwood. The speaker is, actually it's me, but if you want a chance to hear me come hold forth for a longer period of time on one specific subject and take questions and introduce resources and that sort of thing, come check it out Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, Woodland Park Presbyterian Church, 70th and Greenwood. The Social Justice Film Festival begins this week on Friday and continues for several days with all kinds of cool films that'll be out there. Also on Friday, former weather guy Mark Rudd, not weather in the sense of getting on TV and predicting rain for tomorrow, but in the sense of 60s activism, he will be at Town Hall talking about how much of a mistake it was to do violent activism. That'll be at 7:30 on Friday night.
So
Town
the weather,
Hall.
Weather underground, not
yes.
Weather. Yeah, okay.
Yes, exactly. The 7:30 Friday night, that will be free to the public. And that's it for events.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news, commentary, and humor concerning local and national and global news and events. It's an all-volunteer publication and a labor of love that you can find at bookstores and cafes and King County Library System and all other sorts of places where you find free periodicals. We're still very hit and miss in the Seattle Library System. They won't distribute us through their system because, you know, we use bad words occasionally and children might be exposed to words they hear every day. And we also can't say on the radio. Goodness forbid. In any event, other than that, you can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. We are in the midst of our spring fund drive. Because we are an all-volunteer publication, nobody gets paid. All the money goes to the printer. So any support that you can give us would be most helpful. We talked last week about a very generous, large matching grant offer, and several people came through to help fill that, which we very much appreciate. But we're still only about a quarter of our way to our goal for the spring. So if you can help out, there's a PayPal button on eatthestate.org where you can send your check and money order to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. That's P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you have questions on that or would like to find out more, or you have comments on feedback or tips concerning what you hear on this program, our email address is info@eatthestate.org.
And still looking for distributors?
Still looking for distributors. Still looking for a distribution coordinator, in fact. So, it looks like we're going to be in the market soon for another co-editor. So if people have interest in that, give us a shout. Again, P.O. Box 85541 and info@eatthestate.org. And our voicemail for people who want to reach us that way is area code 206-719-6947.